And the chocolates that he brought.
Okay, welcome. Here we are, Masechet Kiddushin. Last week we got off Jeff Sachs, Web Yeshiva, Mishkan Tzipora. Welcome to everyone around the table and those listening in at home. Last week we were discussing this question of Chalitza. And the question arose about Shlichut b'Chalitza. And that sent me down a little rabbit hole of Torah research this week, which I wanted to share with you. But before I do that, I promised the story this came up about Rav Kook's great Ma'alok. So Agnon relates, who had a very close relationship with Rav Kook, of course. Agnon relates the following story. There was a printer in Yerushalayim who was a great, acolyte, devotee of Rav Kook, Talmid of Rav Kook. This is in the 20s and 30s. And, like these old Yerushalmi print shops, people would print, what did you print at a print shop? Pashkevilim, the post, and Modot Evel, and things like that. So the owner of the print shop had a sadar. The sadar is the typesetter. Now, you're all gentlemen of a certain age, even the youngest amongst you, know what a typesetter is. Right. If I was telling the story with young, you have to explain it.
This is the word processor.
Yes. But we all know what it meant to set type. And as they would take, they're publishing a big Pashkevil, a big one of those posters that they slap up on the walls of Mea Shearim. So they'd had a frame and he's setting the letters in type and they'd ink the letters. So the sadar, the typesetter, is setting this moda'a in type. And it's one of these, Harims and Naflu, right? Shumu Shamayim, let the heavens fall about the apikorsis and the kfira and the heresy of Rav Kook. So the owner of the print shop, in other words, somebody had come in to order the poster while the owner was out. So the typesetter took down the text and he started setting the thing in print. The owner of the shop comes in and sees what his worker is preparing. He smashes the tablets and then the letters go flying and he runs to Rav Kook to say, you know what they're saying about you? Don't worry, Rebbe, I won't print it. And Rav Kook says to him, why not? There's like 1,000 printers in this town. If you don't do it, somebody will. So why should you lose out on Parnassa? So that's a good story.
Yeah.
Shlichut b'chalitza. Take these sheets that are here. Well, I hope there's enough, but share them if not. So believe it or not, there is two fat volumes called Chalitza Kehilchata. Like Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata, Tefillah Kehilchata, right? Birkat HaShayotzer Kehilchata. There's a Hagbon Glila Kilchata. Each one is big as a Bava Batra. One volume for Hagbon, one volume for Glila.
Scroll.
I don't think it's art scroll, though. But there's a big two-volume Chalitza Kilchata. Chalitza, after all, is a complicated. It's not Yibum v'Chalitza, it's just Chalitza Kilchata. Yibum is not such a practical halacha that you need to. So Chalitza Kehilchata by Rav Yecheskel Schwartz. This is what you have in front of you. And our topic actually makes up a very small amount of material, the topic of Shlichut, because at least here in the halacha l'maaseh, it seems pretty straightforward. But you see on this page, the footnotes take up a much greater amount of space than the text, right? Shows that in the Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata, right? You could always tell something about the halacha under discussion based upon where the horizontal line is, right? If the horizontal line is very near the bottom, you can understand that the matters under discussion are pretty straightforward and there's pretty much consensus. If the horizontal line dividing the text and the footnotes is much more to the north, giving more real estate to the notes, you can be pretty sure that you're talking about a less consensus topic about which Rav Nirvarth gave you the halacha lamaisa, and of course his shoulders were wide enough to rely on anything he tells you. But understand, look at the notes, because you'll see there are other shitot there, and sometimes those shitot are lahakel, right?
Especially the first dish.
Well, that's a famous case of the difference differences between the first and the second editions, about which I don't know that there were too many changes. The third was mostly changes in the typesetting. But, you know, very famously, Rav Neuwirth had gone to Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who gave a haskama to the book, as he gave to thousands of svarim, not necessarily anticipating that this was going to become the definitive work for practical Hilchot Shabbat in the Jewish home, you know, above and beyond anything else. And once that became the case, Rav Shlomo Zalman took a deeper look at it and expressed his opinions about certain matters that he thought, most famously about the use of the Dud Shemesh, the solar panels on Shabbat, which the first edition of the Shmirat Shabbat was more lenient about, and subsequent editions were more stringent based upon the instructions that the author received from Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach.
The joke is the book is muksa. It's klisha machali.
There's a member of our community who is lenient to use the hot water from the Dud Shemesh on Shabbat. And he told me that he feels justified in doing so because he owns the first edition of Shmirat Shabbat Gilchot HaNazir. So when I asked him if he's ever learned it, he said no. Just merely having it on the premises is permission.
It's fine.
So what? So you can like go look on like the they have a website. There's a website called No, what's it called? Simania, a website which is like a trading place for used secondhand books. So you can maybe go there and look for your first edition of Shmirat Shabbat Gilchot. So here you see that, you know, there's one line of text above and then a lot of footnotes. So it's a more complicated session. But he says here, this is Perek Yud Zayin, this is volume 2, Sif Samich. Ein hayabam yachol la'asot shaliach sheyichaltso raglo shel hashaliach bimkomo. Brother dies. Brother-in-law and sister-in-law are now bezika. They have this connection. Here he calls them the yabam, although of course he's not doing yibum. He's really the.
Well, he's the yabam until
he. I guess he's called the yabam. Right? So let's say the case that we mentioned last time. She's in Yerushalayim and he's in Galicia. She's in Yerushalayim, he's in Portland, Oregon. And El Al hasn't yet started flying these routes because it's 100 years ago or more. And the chance of these two people getting together is minimal. But maybe we can send a shaliach. After all, we know you can be Mekadesh. That's what we've been learning practically almost exclusively for the past number of months. You can be Mekadesh with, and you can be Magarish with a shaliach. You could get married and get divorced with a shaliach. And this chalitza and yibum and etc., doesn't it sound like it's all in the same department? No, but he cannot send someone to to stick his leg out in order to have the shoe removed and the spit spitted on the shaliach. We say shlucho shel adam kemoto. Right, but apparently not his foot. Right? What? No, it's the wife's spit. It's the wife's spit.
She also cannot send.
Ah, and so look at Simon Sam Aleph. Hayavma eina yechola l'shloach shliach sheyichlotza na'al mi regel hayabam. And she, the widow, can't send a shliach to go spit on the foot of the chot, right? And certainly the two of them, and as we know for kiddushin and for gerushin, they can each send a shliach that meets in the middle, and the marriage is affected or the divorce is affected. We agreed that the dafyomi could meet in here at the same time, which is what we used to do a long time ago. So it's an experiment. We'll see how it works out.
How come it wasn't good?
They prefer it's cold. It's they prefer to learn here. I don't know.
There's more snacks in here.
So how come it doesn't work for chalitza? And then sif samech bet yesh mi sheomer. There is an opinion. What does it mean in a halachic text when it says yesh mi sheomer? It is not the unanimous opinion, and it is not the majority opinion. But there is an opinion. Dibemakom igun b'shat hadchak. In a case where the poor young widow would be left in aguna, unable to remarry because she's here and he's there and they can't get together, yechola hayavma la'asot shaliach lachlotz hana'al miregel hayavam. The woman can send her shaliach to do the deed wherever the man is found. Ulam gdolei hapos, but not the other way around, right? He can't send someone to stick out the foot with the shoe on and get the spit. Ulam gdolei haposkim, the great holy learned rabbis, katfu da'af b'makom igun in la'kel b'zeh. But a lot of people thought that even b'shas adchak, even a case of aguna, it doesn't work. So if you look in these footnotes, which I'll just kind of say over on the outside, the main source for this is a tshuva of the Maharam.
That's what shocked me last time. Is it probably not? This should be a Mishnah. Like you expect so many
actually. Yes, yes.
Especially for Yavama, they're the most detailed.
I have a question.
Yeah.
If you could do a shaliach for kiddushin, you could do a shaliach for gerushin. Why can't I just send a shaliach with two letters? One says I'm marrying you, and the other one says I'm divorcing you.
What would that mean?
This way, you don't have to worry about like I can do the chalitza, I can't do the chalitza.
But and it's chalitza and yibam is neither marriage nor divorce.
Mm. Okay.
Right. In other words, well, technically speaking, how is yibum? Yibum is akin to kiddushin. It's not identical. Can yibum be done with a shaliach?
No, because that's just what there's wire way.
Because yibum is accomplished only through marital relations.
So the opposite can't be either.
Oh. In other words, yibum can only. You know, yibum isn't. You get married to the woman. Right. Yibum is basically there's already some kind of marital bond. Note the use of the word some kind. Not really. There's some kind of marital bond that's formed immediately upon the death of the brother. And the mitzvah is fulfilled and the marriage is contracted with the marital relations between the brother-in-law and the widow.
Yeah, there are extensive discussions in Yevamot.
Right.
What's the status?
Right.
Brothers involved in
it. Right.
Hey, just one other question, almost in that connection. Before the tikkun of Rabbeinu Gershon, what would happen to a man who's
already married? There are two brothers, one dies.
No, I understand, but the man who's required to either marry his sister-in-law or do a chalitza, if he's unable to do either one of them, he's unable to
why,
do that.
Why is he unable?
Because of the distance in the case that we're looking at.
Well, now. That's the case we're talking about.
No, I understand. But does that, no, obviously, but does that then put him in the category of someone who himself can't marry?
Well, in other words, since technically, a man can be married to more than one.
Right.
I mean, technically, a man is married. You have two brothers. Both of them are married. One of them drops dead without children. The married brother
still has to. No, I understand.
In the times when Yibum was practiced, could have practiced Yibum.
No, for
and
sure.
Now I have two wives.
Sure,
but he still has to. Still, certainly has to do chalitza.
Right, but at a time. Okay, but in the time after the Tikkun of Rabbeinu Gershon, where
right.
A person couldn't.
Right, so in other words, the Tikkun of Rabbeinu Gershon that you can't have more than one wife, let's say the surviving brother is single.
Right.
So he has this relationship with this woman that
right.
Can't be put into effect because right. There's no practical way for him to get from Portland, Oregon to Jerusalem in 1908.
Right.
That would not prevent him from getting married. What?
Well, that was my question.
That was his question.
I thought you were talking about the guy that's already married.
No, that no, I was.
Even if he's still married. Even
no, that's he was already.
That's a different question. I know that question.
He was already married, so
right, but my question wouldn't be affected.
In other words, the Takana of Rabbeinu Gershon that you can't have more than one wife does not preempt the Zika being formed with your sister-in-law if you already have a wife. That's for sure. That's right. One's a deraita, one's a derabanan.
What do they do with
it? It's not even, by the way, it's not even a derabanan. Right? Depends on the Rabbeinu Gershon. I'm sorry, Shonen.
What did they do 200 years ago when communications were so slow and they find out that someone, a woman got married when she needed to have this?
No, but how would the woman would have known that she's a widow?
Right.
But what if she doesn't know?
The opposite, you could ask.
That there wasn't, that someone died without issue.
How would the woman, what's the case in which the woman doesn't know that she's become widowed?
No, she knows she became widowed, but she doesn't know that there's a brother somewhere.
So it would be a case of shogeg that, in other words, let's say she got married. And I mean, it would be pretty unusual not to know that.
No, you could imagine a scenario where if the brother of the husband who died was born after the, was born, then you wouldn't know. People had kids over the course of 20 years. You could have made aliyah, and your father.
He thought he was an only child.
He thought
he was an only child. He came off on aliyah. After he left, his parents had a ben skunim. He didn't know he had a brother. I mean, I told this story when I went to the army. I told this story recently. When I was a young buck and I came on aliyah and I was drafted and I went to the army for one day. It was a very long day. In those days, at that time in the 90s, you know, they didn't need all of us to go to the army because we were having peace talks with Syria and there were 1.5 million Russians that showed Russians up. And they did, well?
Yeah, the million Russians was the main thing.
Yeah, but we were having peace talks with Syria. And we thought, you know, we were still naive and we thought that people thought that Oslo had done the trick. I remember I went to, in Van Leer, this must have been, this is when I was in Mendel. So that was in like 97, 98, Mashu Kaze. There was a Yomi Yun in Van Leer about how will Israeli society adapt to the new reality, which will soon be upon us, of getting rid of Gius Chova, getting rid of mandatory drill.
Oh, wow.
What? Yes, Mizrach Tikhon Chadash.
Wow.
Right? When our son Shalom was born in 1997, people asked us, was he named after the Tahlich HaShalom, the peace process? So he was named after my grandfather, Shalom, but certainly there was a lot of optimism in the air. So I was drafted. I was drafted for one day. As I was supposed to go for whatever it was, 40 days or something like that. But after one day, they sent us home and said, don't call us, we'll call you. And then a couple years later, I got a Mikhtav Shifur. But on my one day of service to the Jewish army, which again was a very long day. So at the intake in Bakum, you know, where they do all the intake of the new soldiers. I mean, you did this, right?
I did. I actually did.
So the whole day, I mean, it's a little macabre. They take your fingerprints and your footprints, and they take your dental X-rays, and they take an X-ray of your skull, and they draw blood, and meaning it's 101 ways we can identify, God forbid, a part of your body if it comes to that DNA and. And then you sit, you know, like you're opening a bank account at like one of these like cubicles with a little pkida, one of these young chayalot, who's taking all of your information. Are you married? Do you have children? Do you have a brother? Where does your brother live? How old is he? Does he have a tudat zehut? Is he abroad? Is he here? And I understood why she was asking this. Right? But God forbid, and Rahmanis, it's. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if she knew. She was just filling out the form. But how many? I know of three war widows in the past 4 months that are going to need chalitza. Right. In other words, newlyweds, they don't have children yet. Husband was killed. I was at one of these funerals in Paris. Right? The girl's going to need chalitza. It's a tragedy. Yeah. We should all shed a tear. So, but I understood back then that that's what was motivating the question.
Yeah.
And then she says, here, sign this. And what she gives me to sign is the Hatzara. Hinei nishbati l'shmor emunim l'medinat Yisrael, tzva hagana l'Yisrael, erkeah. I take an oath to defect, protect, defend, and the state of Israel and the army and all of its values and etc. And I'm like, oh, are we supposed to go to the Kotel or to Givat HaTachmoshet? Where's my Tanakh? So I said, she said, no, just it's not like that. It's like that with the 18-year-olds, but with you guys, you just sign it. So I said, well, I want to read it first. She said, you know, like when you open a bank account and it's, you know, just. So I said, I want to read it. So she says, it'll take too long. I said, I got no place to go. Am I going to get to go home early if I finish? So she says, fine, but go sit over there in the corner and then come back to
somebody else. Yeah.
So I signed it. I give it back to him. Afterwards, I said, where's my Tanakh? What? You're not going
to tell me. Then.
I still have my Tanakh in the army.
So,
yeah.
So anyway, so that's so Yibum v'chalitza. Yibum v'chalitza. So this question, so Yibum is only performed through the marital act, through the marital sexual act. There's no kiddushin, there's no chuppah, there's no ring, there's no harayat mikudeshet.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's only, right, that's, kiddushin can also be affected, technically, kiddushin can also be affected, kesef, shtar, and bia. Already in the times of the Gemara, Rav Mangid Amanda Mekadish Bebia. Right, the Amoroyim already did away with this idea of people doing kiddushin through the marital act, right? Because it's unseemly, and it might be performed without proper intention, and all types of other things. Right, but which may be part of the reason why Chazal also kind of did away with Yibum. Right, if you look at the Ramban and his discussion, the Ramban ala Torah. His discussion of Yibum, he discussed it because the Ramban, of course, was something of a mystic. So how does Yibum work? The child is born from the union of the brother-in-law, used to be the brother-in-law, the brother of the dead husband and the widow. And it's a kind of, you don't have to be too mystical to understand that there were people that understood that this is a kind of Gilgul Nishamot,
right?
The reincarnation or the spiritual continuation of the brother who died without leaving heirs and without leaving seed and leaving descendants, right? And genetically, it would make sense that this be done through the closest relative, which is the brother. Today, you know, there are questions far above my pay grade of you know, someone is killed and you can harvest semen,
right,
within a small time frame. What's doctor? What's the time frame? A couple hours.
Yeah. No, what? Hold on.
A couple hours.
Or if it was stored beforehand.
Or if it was stored before, right?
Whether that would be boter.
And then she's impregnated with the semen of the dead husband. What does that do in terms of Yibum v'chalitza? I don't know, but it's a question. So.
Did you say actually that in a previous? He dies if she's pregnant, that she's still...
Yes, if she's pregnant when he dies, so then there's no problem. There's no Yibum v'chalitza.
Really?
But yeah.
You think the kid doesn't make it?
No. If she miscarries, then but the kids, yeah, you know, the Gemara in Yevamos also describes these father and son are driving. I mean, I'm modernized the case. You know, right now, it's if the father died at 11 o'clock. And the son died at 11:02. She doesn't need the Yibum v'chalitza.
That's an inheritance question too.
Right. So it's inheritance. But in other words, and then what happens if it's a safek? You don't know who predeceased the other. But here's Aliza Abraham joining the shir. Just a minute ago, she was in my wife's shir, who's teaching at the same time on Wiggins shir. So since Yibum can only be done through the marital act. Right, so obviously it can't be done with a shaliach. Right? And the Ramban says, as that's the Ramban. The Ramban says that it's a strange thing. This is a relationship which under normal circumstances is forbidden. Right? And we're taking something which is normally forbidden, the brother-in-law and sister-in-law, and turning it into an obligation, turning it into a mitzvah. But it's only a mitzvah if it's performed with the right intentions. But if this Yabam and this Yavma have sexual relations, but he's doing it not because he wants to fulfill the mitzvah, but for any other reason a man might want to be with a woman, I'll leave that for you to fill in the blank. Right? So then not only is it not the mitzvah, but it's the same old original Aveira. So that is how the Ramban explains, and a child that would be born of such a union with wrong intention, I don't know whether he's technically a mamzer, but he's certainly in the spirit of the mamzerut, right? A child illegitimately conceived. So that's why Yivamot cannot be done. That's why Yivam cannot be done with Shaliach. So why can't Chalitza be done with Shaliach? So maybe Chalitza can't be done by Shaliach because it's learned from Yivamot. But there are other possibilities. There are other possibilities. If you look on the next page, on this page, this is from a shir by Rav Asher Weiss. I told you I recently went to Rav Asher Weiss's shir on a Thursday night. I didn't tell you this. You know who Rav Asher Weiss is. Rav Asher Weiss gives a shir in Ramot on Thursday nights at 9 o'clock, which is why for 10 years I've been wanting to go, but never made it. Because it's Thursday night, 9 o'clock in Ramot. And I finally made it, and oh boy, was it worth it. If you ever have an opportunity to go to a shir with Rav Asher Weiss, it's like a symphony. It's just brilliant. He's so clear. So it's really incredible. It was really, really an incredible shir. I mean, you can also listen to it online.
English or Hebrew?
In Hebrew. I think once a week every night of the week he's giving a shir someplace else. Right? And one night a week, if you look on his website, this is the website here at the top, minchasasher.com. You can see the schedule. One night a week he gives a shir, I think, in English in Shari Chesed or Nachlaot or someplace like that. And in your shrine. So this is a shir that he gave on this topic a while back.
The transcription.
You know what? I don't know. See, what happened when I was there? They give out this little booklet with the shir already written up, which I think he writes it, and then he delivers the shir based upon this written thing. So I think this is his writing, but I'm not sure exactly the origin of it. So he says, "Hine mivuah bechtubot mesechet klu." But the ain't tonight. Okay. You see, like, go down to the 1, 2, 3, the fourth paragraph. V'gam mashekatuv tekevan dechalitza bimkom yibum kai. Gam bechalitza ein shlichut. That's David. That's your idea. Since chalitza comes in place of the yibum, and yibum obviously can't be done with a shaliach. So to Chalitza. Aval, he says, Tama'ani. I'm doubtful about this. This is not so clear to me. Hallo, kol mitzvah v'gedereha misuyamim. Chalitza is a mitzvah and Yibam a mitzvah. These are two separate mitzvot, according to all opinions. According to all opinions, these are two separate mitzvot. So why do you have to say that one is dependent on the other? Why can't they each have their own operative rules?
Like Kedushin and Gittin, also it's like two sides of the same coin.
So Kedushin and Gittin, you learn out certain things one from the other, but not everything. Not everything. A get has to be written l'shmo. And so much of Gittin, Masechet Gittin, is organized around these laws of l'shmo. There's no l'shmo in Ketubot.
So
right? Right? The Ketubah doesn't have to be written l'shmo. Right? We don't cut and paste all of the halachot of one onto the other. For certain things, we make comparisons. Hello, call mitzvah gedra, I'm assuming. V'hatam she'en shlichut bevia, lo shayach b'chalitza. The reason that you can't have a shaliach for yibum is because, you know, your shaliach cannot perform sexual relations on your behalf. Just like your shaliach, can you make a shaliach? Give me another example of something you can't make a shaliach for.
Tefillin,
you can't make a shaliach to put on tefillin, right? You have to put on tefillin. And any mitzvah that has to be done with your goof can't be done through shlichut. Right? But affecting kedushin isn't a mitzvah that has to be done with your goof, with your body. It's an exchange of an item of financial worth. Right? And that, I mean, we all, what do you do? Like, it's annoying these days to have to take your wallet out of your pocket and fish out your credit card to pay for something in the supermarket. You take your phone, you click, right? And you're done. Right? There's no, what do they call that? Contactless payment. Right? So it doesn't have to be done with your body. Right? I can send you with my phone to the store to click. Right? I don't have to, but whose is it? It's mine. It's my money. I paid for it. So kiddushin isn't something that has to be done by you. It can be done by a shaliach. Yibum. Not so. So I understand why yibum can't be done by the shaliach, but why should that limit what we do with chalitza? Right? Chalitza is this act that has to be performed. Right? With this funny shoe. I told you, you can look at it, you can watch videos of it on YouTube. There's this funny sandal. It looks like tefillin, actually. The way that the sandal, no, I mean, it has ritsuot, right? In other words, it gets wrapped up the leg with the ritsuot, the way that we wrap the tefillin around the arm. And there's this ceremony as described in the Torah. So why does it have to be my foot? I can send my shaliach, shlucho shel adam kemoto, and the spinning and the shoe and will be on his foot, but really it's an extension of my foot. I just like when I sent him with the ring to be Makadesh, his hand is an extension of my hand. Alo kol mitzvah there, I'm assuming v'hatam she'en shlichut b'viya lo shayach b'chalitza. Uma b'kach she'chalitza b'mkom yibum omedet. U'befrat she'en kan din mesuyam she'en shlichut b'yibum. Ela she'en shlichut b'viya. I understand there's no shlichut with marital relations, but why shouldn't there be? The imkain lama lo yehane shlichut bechalitza. Anyway, he goes on. He gives a number of other reasons, and he surveys, as the notes in the previous source from Rav Schwartz, he surveys the different opinions. The main opinion is the tshuva of the Maharam. The Maharam was Rav Shvadrun, who was a great Galician or Poisek. You know, he was really probably around 1900, beginning late 19th, early 20th century. It was probably, you know, the greatest posek, probably I would say in Europe, but that means in the world.
Who is this?
Shvadrun, Rav Shvadrun, known as the Maharam. The Maharsham, So he has a tshuva, which is this case I've been referring to. There's a girl whose brother-in-law is in Portland, Oregon. You know what it meant for a Jew to go to Portland, Oregon in 1900? Right. He wasn't from the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah. As a matter of fact, he was off the derech, as we say. And when he gets the letter that his sister, his brother has died, and his sister-in-law, the woman was in Odessa. The woman was in Odessa. That the brother had died and the sister... So he said, you know, I don't want anything to do with this. He certainly wasn't going to get on a train to New York to get on a boat to travel to Odessa. So she's stuck.
In normal, let's say, in a situation where there's, you know, a real key law with real enforcement, and they live in the same place, and somebody refuses to report to
them. So if it's in the same place, so then we'd whack him, and you know, like any other Aguna case. You know, it would be the same as like an Aguna case. And certainly in those days, they would have known how to take care of him. But in this case, how do you force him to come from Portland, Oregon to Odessa in 1900? So finally, he agreed that if she sent a shaliach, he would participate. Yeah, you can understand how long this all schleps out, sending letters back and forth from Odessa to Portland, Oregon in 1900.
Frisco Kid.
Yes, I thought of the Frisco Kid myself. Yes, yes. Yeah. I have read this book. Didn't understand the word. So how long does it take to you know, to get this done? I mean, it's already a, so he agrees that, you know, if she's not willing to come, he said, I'm not going there. If she's willing to come here, okay, and if not, she can send a shaliach. Whatever reasons, it was not possible or practical for her to travel. So the question was, can she send a shaliach? And the question gets to Rav Shvadrun, who's the, after the death of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who was the posek Hagadol, which is why he gets the yeshiva named after him in Manhattan, by Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, of which I am a proud graduate.
Ritz.
YU is named after Yisrael Elchanan Spector. And he debates back and forth, and he puts forth a kind of argument as a svara, theoretically, how we could possibly, in an emergency case, b'shas sabchak, in a case of aguna, allow shlichut in one direction, meaning the wife sends a shaliach, but the husband cannot send the shaliach. Why? Because it says v'choletz raglo, and that's understood in the Torah as being it has to be his leg mamish, his foot mamish, right? And that I can't send somebody else's arm to put on tefillin for me. I can't send somebody else's foot to do the chalitza. But maybe the wife could send a shaliach, which means that she could also send a man as her shaliach. So you have a man spitting on the man's foot. Right? Or, in theory, a woman.
There must be discussion about the brother-in-law is an amputee, doesn't have feet.
Exactly. The case of that, or the case of a woman who's a gidemet, who's missing her hands, right? Because it says, yes, she has to take her hand and untie the shoe, right? So Gemara says, it's interesting. This case the Gemara mentions, but the Gemara doesn't discuss the case of a shaliach. She would untie it with her teeth,
wow.
Right? she's got no hands. She's got no teeth.
Not marriageable, but
and she's not so marriageable. she's not so marriageable. But you never know. You never know. So Rav Shvadrun says, since nobody agrees with me, since there are no other poskim that agree with me, and as a matter of fact, the Avnei Nezer very strongly disagree. They are like the next greatest posek ador, very strongly disagrees with me. I can't say that we should do this. But he at least puts forth a theoretical model by which we might rely on it, but I guess that lady. But we don't. You know, that's the way it is with Shelo to Chuvot. There's no reportage. There's no follow up about the case. We don't know who she was, and we don't know who he was, and we don't. But presumably she was stuck forever. Okay, so that's the case of shlichut. That's the case of shlichut in chalitza. I mentioned that I was first interested in this topic, not so much for Talmud Torah purposes, but because of my Agnon interests. This is a case in a particular story by Agnon. In Agnon's magnum opus, T'mol Shel Shom, it's exactly this time. And I presume that Agnon knew this tshuva by the Marsham, who was a Galitzianer and who was contemporaneous to the story taking place during the Second Aliyah. Because what happens in this story is the husband dies. He has one little brother who lives back in Uchach, in what today is Western Ukraine. And it's made very clear there's no scenario by which that little brother is ever going to make it to Eretz Yisrael. And the poor, really destitute widow, who's about 19 years old, she's an orphan and she's, right, there's no scenario by which she's going to make it to Uchach. So for all intents and purposes, she's an aguna. So Agnon, it was found, after Agnon died, it was found in his archives, Agnon had written a chapter, a concluding chapter, or a coda to the book, which he did not publish. He wrote it and then took it out. And in that coda, what happens is that we discover, you know, like sometimes at the end of the movie, they tell you 20 years later, like you skip mm-hmm. ahead to find out what happened to the characters, that in fact, the widow, who by the way, the husband dies, the husband is bit by a rabid dog during the week of their Sheva Brachot and dies the terrible death of rabies. But it turns out that during their Sheva Brachot, which means presumably on their wedding night, she became pregnant. And she gave birth to a son 9 months later, eight and a half months after her husband died. And that son grew up. And like many young men born during the second Aliyah, he goes off a generation later to the kibbutz, where he marries the daughter of other characters from the book, right? In other words, we find out that these other characters, that they had gotten married and they had a child, and these two, the next generation, the two children. But in the Avnon world, this happens not infrequently, that the next generation tries to fix what went. So according to the not censored, but the, what do you call it? The ganuz, the deleted ending. There's no aguna problem. There's no chalitza problem because she was pregnant.
But she didn't know that.
It doesn't matter. She, in other words, once she didn't know it the day that her husband died, right. 2 weeks later, she knows that she's pregnant because she's not a woman.
Why do you think I cut it out?
Exactly. Why is it out?
He wanted people to know that we're willing to go all the way with the halakha, and this would have been an easy out.
No, that's true, but that's not why he did it. I don't think he did it because the work is a tragedy, and if you include it, that's it obviates the tragedy.
Right.
It leaves an element of happily ever after. But if
that's saying different words, what I said.
Well, maybe. Except, in other words, when you're writing a tragedy, characters have to suffer.
Right, it's a tragedy.
And the tragedy is that not only does the protagonist die a terrible death, not only is his wife left a widow, but she's left in Aguna. She's 19 years old. She has no reasonable way to support herself, right? Her father has died earlier in the story, and she can't get married. Right? So that makes it a tragedy. That makes it a tragedy. And in order to preserve the tragedy, we have to get rid of an ending which would have reversed that.
I think Rav Avadia Yosef would have found a way to...
Maybe some contemporary poskim would have found a way to do something.
And he was the son of Yibam.
Right. But...
I think teacher instead of a case of a bomb, sir. It's not his whole idea, but he goes and lives somewhere where nobody knows.
Yeah, so that's...
And you don't tell.
And who's the wiser? And that also appears, by the way, that also appears in Agnon, and no doubt that's what happened in the Mishnah cases. Don't ask, don't tell. I want to remind you of the Mishnah that we're still working off of.
We don't do the same thing.
I want to remind you of the Mishnah that we're still working off. You remember this crazy case? Speaking of crazy cases, you don't have it in front of you. I mean, you can skip back, you can turn back in the Gemara. Ma'aseh bechamesh nashim, five women, uvehem shtei achayot, two of whom are sisters. Viliket echad, and a fella comes along and he picks kalkala shel te'inim, a basket full of figs. Why do they have to be figs?
Mishnah likes figs.
Mishnah does like figs. Mishnah does like figs.
I'm trying to try a fig this week in our country.
Really? Yeah, 30 years you're living in the country, she never had a fig.
I give it a try. And I think a lot of people...
First of all, where did you get figs?
Dried figs.
No, but
there's all these stories about how they're, you know... You hear a story once about how they're
water.
They're made like wasps and things, and that's how they're pollinated.
Yes.
And she, as a kid, made her not want to... Anyway, so she was saying she had about it. I said, I want to make this look like I got a cake. I said, that half the mission
is... That is right. Right. Well, yeah, I mean, fresh figs are delicious, of course, but figs are...
One week, they're right.
Figs are pricey. because they have a short shelf life, and right. So a fig is certainly shavapruta, right? And as if he picked five grapes, grapes not shavapruta.
The price is grapes in the decalate, might be.
Strawberries. Each strawberry is certainly worth a shavapruta. So he picks a basket. He picks a basket of figs. V'shelahen haita, but these figs belonged to the women. V'shel shviat haita, but it happened to be shmita, which means what? That they're hefker. V'amar hare kuchen mikudashot li bekalkala zu. You are all simultaneously betrothed to me with this basket of figs. V'kibla achat mehem, and one of them accepts the figs, al yidei kulan, as the shlicha, for acting on her own behalf and as the shlicha of the other four. V'amru chachamim, ein ha'achayot mekudashot. He's married to three of them, but the two sisters are out of the game. They cancel each other out. Why?
Because you can't marry two sisters.
Because you can't simultaneously be married to two sisters. To two sisters, and the act is being taken is occurring in one fell swoop.
The question about the shmita thing: wouldn't it be hefker for, like, how can he be zoch? He can actually own the food if he takes the shmita.
David, as you know from having looked ahead at the Gemara, this is exactly the question that we're going to ask. So look here. We're on Nun Beis Omud Aleph, about 10 lines down by the two dots. Last week we left off with Ya'al Kagam. Yael Kagam, perfect name for, there must be a Kagam family someplace. They should own their daughter Yael. Ma'aseh b'chamesh nashim, our Mishnah. What?
Okay. What's the first line of the...
The first word is kivate, but it's the two dots. It's about 10 or 12 lines down, and there's two dots in the middle. Ma'aseh b'chamesh nashim, our Mishnah. Omar Rav, shma mina mimatniten arba. Well, first of all, fall off your chairs, gentlemen and ladies, because what is the Gemara always saying? Shma mina tlat. This is a kind of Gemara construct. There's a story, and the Gemara says, from this story, we can infer three halachot. You know, this rule of three in literary studies, mm-hmm. is an idea of the rule of three. The three bears, the three little pigs, the right. What? Why does? I mean, in children's literature in particular, and in agadot, and in folklore, right? You often things come in threes.
In the army too.
Why?
Everything is Mr. Lake for three.
Why?
I know, fine public speaker. Every time they give a question at a Bartorah lecture,
yeah.
The answer is always the three
right.
Answers.
Right. So there are, right? Al shloshat dvarim ha'olam omed. Right? There are three pillars, Torah, Avodah, Vagamir, Chasadim. So it's tzedek, din, u'mishpat, right? In other words, this idea that summarizing, well, first of all, it's like a mnemonic. It's easy to remember. Everybody can remember three things. If I send you to the store for milk, bread, and eggs, you're going to remember that. Once your wife throws in the fourth thing, Gunnar Shelf.
What are you saying?
The list I'm not buying it.
But also for storytelling, you need three items to establish a pattern. What? Right? In other words, if you have two things, you don't know if you have a pattern.
A chazoka.
Three things also a chazoka. Right, but in other words, if the bed is too big, too small, just right, porridge is too hot, too cold, just right, so then you can establish a pattern that you know by which the story is going. So the Gemara is always saying Shema Minat Lat. There's a story. I mean, it's like a story, like this rabbi did this thing. So we want to infer from the story that we can determine based upon the principle that the actions of the righteous are teachable moments, right? If we saw a rabbi eat something, so we can infer that it's kosher, right?
Or if he saw us.
Or if he saw
us eat something.
Eat something.
And I was eating it under rabbinical supervision.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, or I saw that Tzvi was eating something, and he was sitting next to a holy rabbi, David, right? So Mistama, it was kosher, because David wouldn't have let him eat it. If it wasn't kosher, because David's a holy roller and he's very careful about mitzvot. And then, of course, but whenever you're trying to infer fact from reality, so then you can always shrug it up, right? Ah, you thought you saw him eating this? How do you know it was this? Maybe it was that. Right? You know, there's a story about Rav Moshe. About Rav Moshe, you know, Rav Moshe Feinstein very famously was lenient about Chalav Stam, right? In other words, the idea that you have to have Chalav Yisrael, which once upon a time, now in America, you can get Chalav Yisrael every place. What?
Not so easily in some places.
I mean, maybe not in Montana.
In the big Jewish community, right?
But it used to be harder to come by. And Rav Moshe very famously had a psak about the milk, that all the milk under the FDA, meaning all the milk that's sold
is cow milk.
It's cow milk. You can rely on the fact that they don't put in pig milk or camel milk or who knows what, because the government is there doing it, and the farmers have no reason not to give you only cow milk, because A, it's more expensive to give you camel milk or pig milk, and B, they have the fear of the government on them, so why would they want to get in trouble for no good reason? So you can assume that there's a story there. If Moshe is at a Piduna Ben or a Riss or a, and there's two bottles of milk, and one is Chalav Yisrael and one is Chalav Stam. Mm. So he picks up the Chalav Stam, puts it down. Picks up the Chalav Yisrael, puts it in his coffee. Somebody says, "See, he didn't really mean it. He thinks really you have to have Chalav Yisrael."
The Chalav Stam was empty.
It was empty. So like you have interpreting. I mean, that's a story they tell. Who knows whether it's true or not, right? But I heard that once. I heard it from Rabbi Tendler, who was the son of it. Yeah. What?
Rabbi Tendler would know it. I heard something similar. He got two cartons of Don Dairy Creamer in front of him, and he shook one, and then the other. He was like, "Why did Rabbi Moshe do that?"
Right.
It would be some great significance.
Yes, particularly Talmidim like to look carefully and analyze little details and make mountains out of molehills, and you know, it's part of being in yeshiva. It's like a recreational sport. And of course, you know, very famously, knew the case of
bending down.
No, the Rebbe's bed.
The fingernails. The cutting the Rebbe's foot.
In the Gemara.
So he built a little bit of an
Yitzchak. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Talmud hides underneath the Rebbe's bed because he wants to learn the proper conduct between a man and wife in private. What?
Torah.
Torah Ilamada. It's Becholzot. It's not proper. So, so the Gemara says, Omar, from this crazy case, the guy with the figs, with the five women. So the Gemara says, so Rav says, you can learn four things from it. So already we're like off of the template. Benakit Rav Biyadei Tlat. As he said, we can learn four things, but it's only apparent what the three things are. And the Gemara, which we're not going to finish tonight, the Gemara tries to figure out what's the fourth thing that he thought you could learn from it. So what can be learned from this case in the Mishnah? Shmamina, we can learn from it, that if somebody performs an act of Kiddushin using Shemitah fruit as the agent of Kiddushin, it works. What would be the Havamina that it wouldn't work?
Because he doesn't own what he's giving her as a...
No. If you acquire Perot Shemitah, right? In other words, you're allowed to own Perot in Kiddushat Shvit. Right?
It belongs to women. So, you know,
In the field, it's hefker.
But can you do mischar with perot shvit?
Mischar is something else.
Well, isn't that a
problem? But can you
be for a woman?
I don't know if it's mischar.
Isha nikne.
Okay. If you have a bottle, I have in my house right now yayin kedusha shvis. Right? Whose property is it? You can buy still in the market wine and it says on it, Kadosh B'Kedushat Shvit. Mm-hmm. Right? It had to have Bi'ur, It had, we're not going to go into all the details, right? It was purchased through the Otzer Betin, right? It's Kedushat Shvit, which means I'm not allowed to spill it down the toilet. If you come into my house and you steal that bottle of wine, are you stealing?
Yes.
Why? Because it's my property. You can acquire Kedusha Shvius within certain amounts, like the amount that a normal person can use. I can't warehouse it. I can't buy barrels and barrels of it and put it aside.
But you can sell it.
You can't sell it in normal ways. But you can. I could give it to you as a gift. I come to your house, I can give it to you. Right? It's true that we say Haisha Niknate. What is that, Sfora? Don't tell your wife that you think it's Sfora.
So say it depends on the
right? Right? So the Gemara says, if you're Makadesh, a woman with Peirot Shvit, Mikudeshet. Maybe Lechatchil, you shouldn't have done it. But it's an exchange of something of value. And if, as long as it's a Shavet Pruta, right, she's Mikudeshet. So Shema Mina.
She doesn't have Kedushat Shvit.
Who doesn't have Kedushat Shvit?
The woman.
She doesn't become a... She's Mikudeshet. She's an Ashish. She's not Mikudeshet. Shema Mina, Kidsha Begezel, Eina Mikudeshet. But if I steal something, I go to the jewelry store and I knock over the jewelry store and I take a ring, which is Shavet Pruta. It's the same wedding ring somebody was planning on marrying his own wife with. And I say, Harayat Mikudeshet Li. And I'm a Kudeshit. Why?
It's the one
way. So why? What's the problem?
It's not yours.
Oh, it's not mine.
But I thought if you steal something, you do acquire that you owe its value.
In other words, this is okay. So this is a machlokes tzvi and rav. Rav says, "Ain't I'm a Kudeshit." Right? Under certain circumstances, the gazlan is Kone, the object, even though he's always obligated to pay back the value.
But he's
not Kone the object immediately. No. He's not Kone the object unless he's done a number of things, which we learned a while back, the Gemara in Sukkah, about cases when you have Lulav HaGozel, what has to be affected in the object that you acquire the object as your own property, yeah, all the while that you still owe money. Anyway, we're in the middle here. We'll continue this. We'll continue this next week.
Jeff, can you hand me a pen? Just one second.
If anyone built that,
yes, just be, it's a fountain pen, so be delicate.
I'm really fine. No idea, I know.
I have
an armory. I have an armory.